Ambassador Faulkner will give a brief opening statement, then we'll take your questions. As we did with Ambassador Stephenson, we'll have about 30 minutes. Ambassador Faulkner, please.
Thanks, Keith. To be honest, I think this is basically a document which shouldn't have many surprises, if any, in it. It could hardly be described as an exciting document, and its release certainly can't be compared to what's going on down in Cannes with Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skulls, which is where I'd much rather be right now, if I'm perfectly honest with you. For what it's worth, I think it's, and I hope it is, a document which clarifies the options, gets rid of a fair bit of the undergrowth, simplifies things. I would look at it as being, you know, pretty close to the last Chinese doll, the last Russian doll that you have inside those Russian doll exercises. I don't know whether there's another one or two in there, but not much more to go, I think, before you run out of timber. Or balsa wood, as they are these days. So I think that's pretty much what it is. It's basically a filtration, a sort of filter has been applied to what was in the previous version based on the discussions over the last 3 months. Most of the things that are in here I have pretty clearly foreshadowed to the members anyway. And I don't think there's anything in that sense which is particularly new. And as I say in the covering letter, I have tried to provide, in some cases, clear text where there's not agreement for clear text, but I don't see the point in having fine distinctions left in the document, 1 or 2% here or 3 or 4% there. It's kind of academic, actually, compared to the choices which have to be made, and I thought it's much more useful at this stage in the negotiation, which is presumably the penultimate stage, to have that kind of clarity where it seems politically feasible to do it, so that people don't haggle over whether it's 1 or 2% up or down, which is infinitesimal compared to what's going on in the real world. So that's why I've adopted this kind of approach, which means a dramatic shrinking of the square brackets in the document, which in a certain sense were only there formalistically before. That's why I say I don't think there's that much that's fundamentally different. So I don't know whether you want to be bored rigid by me going through all the bits and pieces in here that I think are different or worthy of comment. I'll make an effort to do that. What I would say is that I think that what this document represents is that anybody who's got the eyes to see can now see clearly the summit that you're trying to climb. You know, we've got through, in my view, the cloud layer, and we're getting pretty thin on oxygen. But the task now is, I think, on the basis of this, we could go on and finish the job. Or as a famous New Zealander once said, knock the bastard off. And I think that's what we could and should do. I think the... that doesn't mean knock the bastard off the top of the mountain, just in case some of you have that in mind. I'm sure some of the members might prefer to do that. As far as the thing itself is concerned, and if you've got specific questions, it's probably the best way to deal with it. I think what I've done in there, just to comment on a few things, for instance, on the market access side, on the tariff cuts, I've kind of split the difference on those, except for the top band, which is the most politically controversial one, I suppose. But frankly, I already know in my own mind where you're going to end up in the top band, but out of politeness and respect, I've left that one there within a range. I've taken the square brackets off a number of things, including the overall average tariff cut. It doesn't mean there's agreement on that, but it's just that I think that that's realistically where people are going to go, and you don't get any advantage by putting all these things in square brackets in a kind of timid and overly demure way. I've given some more specification on the tariff quota expansion details in the document. I've tickled the text on the RAMS provisions. I think I've simplified and clarified the options on SP and SSM. The tropicals and preferences text is essentially unchanged, although its presentation's a little different, just reflecting the fact that they are not ready yet for anything, and the clear understanding was that if they're not ready when we go to print, then you get the previous version, and that's what I've done there. On the sensitive products stuff, I've been able to considerably shorten Annex C because large chunks of what was in Annex C have now been incorporated into one of the options, which is the G6 option, which is in that text as one way of dealing with the sensitive product calculation. And I've retained another option to reflect the position of others who won't have a bar of that particular approach, but that option is relatively short and straightforward. On the small and vulnerable economies, the text has been clarified on that. There have been some doubts in the discussions about what it really meant. People really seem to want belts and braces on that stuff, but I hope I've now provided belts, braces, rubber bands, and hydraulic gear if necessary to make it clear. The escalation text is manifestly clean. I'm not sure that they've agreed it by any means in all its detail, but I don't think we'll end up very far away from that. I've simplified the choice on the tariff simplification. It's a very straight choice there, and on the special safeguard. On the domestic support, I mean, all of the headline numbers remain basically stable because they've been stable for a long period of time. They don't even bother discussing them in my process more recently. They're straight political choices now. They remain in square brackets just as they have been. But in a certain sense, they're now easy. I mean, they're clearly the big decisions on those will only be made by ministers. But there have been some areas there which I've clarified. I've simplified the document, I think, in the blue box area, got rid of some of the options that were there before, which I don't think have any support. Some greater clarification for the status of developing countries in the blue box. I think the concept of down payment, which I introduced in the last document, is relatively stabilised, and it's in the text on that basis. And on export competition, basically, I think on export credits and food aid, those documents that I've put forward, again, they're not formally agreed in the form they're in, but I think they represent where I believe they'll end up, and they're clarified in certain areas, and a little bit of minor doctoring being done to them compared to the last text, and a few political decisions left there, particularly on the food aid side. And on the STE document, there's still just one political choice to be made, as there is in the overall export credit exercise. So that's just a quick tour of the horizon on those things. I'm happy to answer anything more specific that you ask if I'm in a position to answer it. And that's pretty much where I think we are. And, well, as far as everybody seems to want to talk about process, I will have a meeting on the week of the 26th. I presume that we'll take all of that week, at least, because I think there are plenty of things that we could do. I've given some indication in the covering letter of areas where I think if officials continue to work seriously and intensively, we could still make progress on what's presently in this text and refine and clarify some of the areas that still are either in square brackets or I feel are actually contested, even though I've put clean text in them. And it wouldn't be technically difficult for me to adapt bits of the document to reflect any emergent agreement in that week. Beyond that, I won't predict, because I don't know. I don't think anybody knows what happens after that. It'll depend a bit on how the discussions go, both on agriculture and NAMA, let alone what happens on other texts that may or may not emerge in the meantime. And I don't think anybody really knows what will happen after that point. What I do know is that there's actually no reason that I can think of why, as far as agriculture is concerned, we couldn't still make progress in that week, and we should try to do so. That still remains my view. And given that I don't believe that there are that many issues left in agriculture, actually, based on where the process has got us to this point, what I've described in the covering notice, hot points, most of them will probably, hot spots will probably remain all the way to ministers. I don't think it's a long way away from being able to resolve it if you were only looking at agriculture, but of course nobody is only looking at agriculture. So we'll see how we get on in the week of the 26th. Thanks.
First question for John, then Ravi.
Good morning, Ambassador. I was wondering if you could shed some light on how the U.S. farm bill, the $300 billion amount over 5 years, impacts on some aspects of your text, especially Section G on cotton and domestic support. And secondly, the reclassification of some programs of the Common Agricultural Policy, how they also impact. Thank you.
Well, I don't know is the honest answer as far as the farm bill is concerned. It may surprise you, but believe it or not, I don't spend most of my waking minutes reading and following what is and is not going on that. Not because I don't care, but just more recently I've been too busy getting this damn thing out. But look, I mean, as far as that is concerned, no matter what ends up in it, whether it's vetoed or not vetoed or whatever, you know, the name of the game with any new one is the same as with any existing one. It rests on the assumption that the administration will, at some point, if we get an agreement here, ensure that its domestic legislation is in conformity with that agreement. Just as on any other area of the negotiations, there may be existing legislation which is or is not in conformity with other parts of this negotiation that will come out of it. Are the political signals propitious for people who want a big, bloated farm bill? Is that ideal at the moment in which you're doing a negotiation? You'd presumably prefer not to have it. But in terms of the specific question, in principle, it can be dealt with if the administration can deal with getting that, if it is passed, into the shape that's consistent with whatever we come out with. On the EU, it's the same answer, essentially. One assumes that they're negotiating on the basis of what they know has happened to their existing policies and where their policies will go, and the categories that we have in terms of the amber, the overall, the blue, and the green are presumably things that they believe they can meet, because they've been pretty active in the negotiation, and they know where it's heading, and I think we know what the parameters are. So one assumes that they believe that they can get themselves into conformity with it.
Robbie, and then Richard.
Sorry, a couple of questions, just three questions. To start
that
with...
That would be five, then.
First and foremost, coming as regards the square brackets, the number that I've counted now comes down to about 30-odd. Is that correct, factually? And second, there is an assumption that the text on domestic support continues to pander to the American interests. Would you, in the face of what's happening in the real world, recognize the need for having an eligibility criteria in the green box? And my third question on SPs and SSMs. On SPs, you have basically included a proposal from, I mean, you have retained some of the older elements, but you also included the American proposal of 8% as the minimum. Why couldn't you just stick to your earlier proposal of 12 to 20% as it was in the February text? And then on SSM, you have not changed, I mean, the three products continue to be there. This is again an American demand. Why couldn't you stick to the G33 demand on this issue?
I haven't counted the square brackets. My impression was about a couple of dozen in there, but I trust your capacity to count. So there might be as much as that. And as I say, I don't think you can judge whether there's political consensus or not by counting the brackets, frankly. But that could well be in the ballpark, so you'll have to, you know, make your own judgment. I haven't counted them there, and I'll give you my official version when I've gone round to counting them up. On the domestic support numbers, you can take your own view on that, but what I'm reflecting in the document represents a stable, I wouldn't say consensus, but a stable position within the negotiating group since the text was produced in July of last year. When the US said on OTDS, I think it was in September, that they accepted that those were the parameters within which they would negotiate, nobody said, and nobody has said since, in any process that I've been in, that they reject that and that they want to go outside those parameters, okay, in my negotiating group. So, now, I'm not saying that even if they had said that I would have done any differently, but the fact is they didn't. And so I'm just simply reflecting where, within that range, till this point in time, the implicit consensus is. That's all. Now, whether that changes in the future is anybody's guess, but that is the reality, and so I don't have much alternative but to reflect that. It's one of the things which has been pretty clear in an area where lots of things have not been clear for many months. As far as... I wasn't quite sure I understood your question about the green box, to be honest, Ravi.
Can I repeat that question?
On the green box, yeah.
Yeah, green box. Given the current farm bill having agreed for $250,000 as some kind of a subsidy which they would get, and given the huge, green box payment, would you now agree for having an eligible, or would you recommend having an eligibility criteria as demanded by several countries?
Well, again, I'm not quite sure what you mean by the eligibility criterion, but I mean, basically on the green box, again, that text reflects pretty much what people have been arguing, both sides, in terms of realistically what they expect to get out of it. There's not a huge lot of change in the discussions I've had in the green box for several months, certainly not since the text was created. As far as the green box is concerned, because the green box is supposedly items that are not trade distorting, the question of how much money you throw at it or hose into it is largely irrelevant. I mean, if you're spending that money in a way which is non-trade distorting, then while it's probably at the margins and with very vast numbers, you might have a different view. It's not the relevant consideration. The question is whether the criteria for judging whether that money is being spent in a non-trade distorting way are correct or not. And so the discussion has not been over the quantum of money that's in the green box, essentially, but about whether the criteria are right, and the text is meant to deal with that. On the SPSSM, I don't think you're quite right. I mean, what I've done in the present version on SP as far as the 8% is concerned has reflected what was previously in the text. It's not changed. US position, to my understanding, was that 8% was a maximum, not a minimum. Okay, they want a maximum. I mean, if you read my text, what it actually says is that, in my view, the minimum will be 8%. Now, whether the minimum is also the maximum is a negotiable question. That might well be the case. But that option of whether you go between 8 and 20 or whatever is still exactly the same as it was in my previous draft. There's no difference to that whatsoever. Yeah, what was your question on SSM again?
On the three products that, the list of the eight products that any country can use, there were demands that this is not the right way to approach the issue.
I mean, there are demands on all sides. I mean, I've kept the same number of products in the document, just three to eight products, as I had in the previous version, and that is one of the areas where I've kept it in square brackets, precisely because it's manifestly contested. But what nobody, the reason why I've stuck with it is the same as why I explained in the negotiating group. The reason, when we have the discussions on special safeguard measure, nobody, including the G33, argue with the proposition that the special safeguard measure should be applied willy-nilly whenever anybody wants it. So there's an understanding that as a special safeguard measure, it's not something that's going to be used very often. And it was clear from the discussion, I'm not saying people agreed to it, that in light of the very many difficulties we have over SSM, the only way you'd actually get to a point where you can have an outcome is if you have at least a constraint on what the upper level of that invocation will be in any given year. And nobody actually had a substantive reason to say that they actually expected in a given year they would generally be using more than in that range. I mean, I understand why people say we'd rather not have a limit at all, but that's a negotiating position. And there are plenty of people who don't want any SSM, so I'm not going to reflect that in the text either. So 3 to 8 is in there. What I have clarified in the footnote is that, and it wasn't perhaps as clear in the previous text, and people had misunderstood that, and there was more discussion, I think, on that than on the actual number of the products, is that in respect of each product, there can be a maximum number of tariff lines attached to each product, so that the number of tariff lines at the upper end would get up to 64, let us say. And I don't think people had quite understood that in the previous text, and that was my fault because I hadn't made it so clear in the footnote that they were the lines for each product rather than another way of repeating what was there on the product. So it hasn't fundamentally changed. And, you know, that's obviously something which remains to be negotiated. I don't have the answer to that yet. Can't pretend I do.
Okay. Richard, then Dan, please.
Could you say a little bit more about these hot spots that you said that need political decision by the ministers? I mean, what would you say are the two or three items that will have the need of a real push by the ministers after the discussions among senior officials? And the other question is more a little bit of actual temperature. Do you think that this discussion about food price increases has an impact on your delegates, that they want to push forward to get to an end of the agricultural discussion? or is that a non-issue?
Well, on the first one, on the hotspots, I won't give you a definitive list. Not because I have it and I don't want to reveal it. I'm not really sure at the penumbra what the exact list is, but some things seem to me to be pretty clear. The OTDS number for domestic support is clearly going to be a political decision. I mean, that range has remained stable. The reason the range has remained stable is because no official wants to negotiate about it. They know that that's going to be political. It seems to me that the base period for the AMS for the US is going to remain a political decision as well. I think that on the market access side, for instance, I'm pretty clear in my own mind, by the way, where those numbers would come out. But I'm never going to get the chance to write that. It's clear to me because that will only be political. But on the market access, a bit the same. I mean, the number of sensitive products and the percentage of domestic consumption for sensitive products are 4 to 6. Okay, that range of 4 to 6 has remained stable in the document for quite a long time, and I think politically they will be decisions that ministers will make as to which end, because they're an ambition question. Again, I think anybody who sits through the negotiations probably knows which one's going to prevail or what number's going to prevail, but that will be a political decision for those. And I suspect that on special products, for instance, at the very least, the number of special products that have no tariff cuts, or indeed if any of them have no tariff cuts, will be a political decision. And I think those are linked together. And indeed, because they're linked together, it's very unlikely that on those elements you'll ever get the officials making those decisions even in the week of the 26th. Now, for some of the others that are in those square brackets, you might actually surprise yourself and officials might be able to resolve them. So there's some in which I am a little bit in two minds as to whether they're political or not, but some are pretty clearly, and I've given you an example of some of those. It's not an exhaustive one. On the food price thing, I would have thought so, and I think they are conscious of it. And even in the world of trade negotiations, the real world does intrude occasionally. I think it has weighed on them, and I think in many ways, but from the point of view of our present situation, I think its operational consequence is to stress the urgency for getting this done, because the real world has other problems that it needs to move on to. And while this might also, as a result, make a contribution to helping with that problem in the medium term, it's also a way of demonstrating that you can make progress in a way that means you can move on to deal with the other issues as well. So I think in that sense it should be positive, but there are signs that it's there, but it's not dictating the detail of the negotiation in any real way. And that's not a surprise, because the negotiation can't give a short-term answer to that problem. Regrettably, I wish it could, but it will operate, if it operates at all, in the medium term. So if you're a policymaker wanting to deal with the fact there are people out there starving right now, you wouldn't come here first. You have to go somewhere else. And that's quite right.
Dan Prusin, please.
Actually, my question was about the food price one. But if I could just seek some clarification. I thought I saw something in the text, and I admit I was reading it late and blurry-eyed, so I might have misinterpreted, that there was an additional line in the text about if food prices exceed a certain level, developing countries would have some flexibilities on that. Did I misread that, or is there something new in your text on that?
I feel sorry for you, Dan. You're showing signs of trade negotiation capture syndrome. Actually reading these documents in detail. I'm impressed. No, I mean, I suppose when I say not really, I mean I'm not in the macro sense making a real impact. There's a little bit in there. One member raised, it's a rather technical point, but it's on the penumbra of the consequences of the food price rises, which is that you have a part of the agreement which talks about a fixed reference price when you calculate the AMS. In other words, when you work out whether you've got domestic support in your own market, you compare to a base price, which is a historical price for the product concerned, which is set in the past. Well, that set in the past is a long way in the past, and it's quite a lot lower than what prices are now. And for one particular member, That's created a bit of an anomaly because it means that on paper their AMS has gone up considerably, even though in a certain sense they're not really being more distorting than they used to be. And all that is to sort of say, well, you know, you could have a bit of a problem of this kind somewhere, and you could make provision through a provision that existed in the text originally for inflation to deal with that in the same way. There's a little suggestion to deal with that, but it's a very specific thing. It's not a generalised thing. I suppose it has an impact in the way in which I've dealt with, particularly the export credit text, perhaps in the final version, in that it has impacted. I mean, when you're dealing with what the repayment term should be for food importing poorer countries when they're purchasing via access to export credit regimes, I think in the present circumstances it has considerably more force when those members say to you, yeah, but don't make that period of time too short because, you know, we actually would like to feed our population. And when you're making the marginal decision about whether it's 360 or 540 days, we'd really rather have the 540, thank you very much. I think in a situation like that, even in Geneva, I think it kind of tips the balance one way rather than the other. So there are a few little areas like that where I think it has a bit of an impact. But They're not absolutely central to the negotiation, certainly. Now, whether when you deal with the so-called hotspots at a more political level at some point in the future, it impacts on those, perfectly conceivable at the macro level, but within the process at the moment, no.
Did you want to follow up, Dan?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about what your role in the future is as well. Ambassador Stephens is not here, but after next week, do you now step aside and allow the senior officials and ministers to go at it? Do you serve in an advisory capacity to these officials? Do you still play an active role, or do you go back home and relax and watch the fireworks?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, I meant it when I said I don't know what happens after that. I really don't know what happens after the week of the 26th. And we'll see. I mean, in a certain sense, it depends on what the members want to do. And I'm available to do whatever fits in with their plans about how they want to process this. If they want to keep working, it's their decision to keep working in whatever format, and they want me to be involved in that, then I'm happy to keep working in that format or whatever. If they don't, that's fine too. I don't know what I'd do. I've forgotten how to do anything else. But I reckon I could probably learn something.
Takafumi, please.
Regarding export prohibition and restriction issue, you didn't include Japan and the Swiss proposal in the text this time. Could you clarify the reason why you didn't do that this time? Thanks.
Well, I mean the text on export prohibitions and restrictions is still the same as it was in the previous version, and it is true that since the end of my consultation process, i.e. in the informal open-ended process, Japan put forward a new proposal. But that came at a point which was after the discussions that we'd had. It got a kind of quick formal reaction in what's called the informal open-ended room, which I think at the time I described as pretty cool. And I think that's cool as in the temperature as opposed to what John referred to as the vibe. That being so, I didn't really feel I had any basis or could legitimately put into the text something that came in, as they say, after the final whistle blew. In saying that, there were some other things which came in after the final whistle blew, and I've treated them the same way. But, you know, if we meet again on the 26th, obviously there could well be an opportunity for Japan and for those who share those views to bring those back to the table, and if there's some elements of consensus that were to emerge on that in that meeting, then obviously if I do another adaptation, that could be revised. But that depends on how it's received in any process that I'm able to start in the week of the 26th. I'm working on the assumption that I have a process in the week of the 26th. It's only an assumption on the basis of call a meeting and they will come. They may decide they don't want to, but I assume that they'll turn up at least for a day or two.
Last question for Isabel, please.
Ambassador, when do you think is the last opportunity for ministers to meet in order to allow you to finish your work, even this year or any close time?
I don't know what the last opportunity is. I mean, how many times have people told you it's the last opportunity? You know, it's probably so. I ain't going to add to the list. You know, you better ask them. I don't know. I'll just keep trucking on with this until somebody says it's all over, Rover.
Thank you, Ambassador Faulkner. Thanks to all of you.